Coming up on Path to Zero.
A lot of these stories follow sort of the law of unintended consequences. People do something, you know, we can talk about some of the interventions that people have made that have turned out to have sort of surprising effects, and then they go searching for a fix.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. Have you ever heard the phrase that it's better to be lucky than good? Well, on today's episode, we're going to be both. I'm so excited and so lucky to be able to talk to one of the foremost writers of our era on the subject of climate change and the state of the earth. You might be familiar with Elizabeth Colbert as an environmental journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker since 1999, but she may be best known for her Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Sixth Extinction. We're going to talk to Elizabeth about her latest book, Under a White Sky, which looks at human intervention with nature and how our efforts to fix the environment can cause even bigger problems. Colbert traveled around the world to meet with scientists and other experts to discuss their plans to counteract climate change and came away from that experience with some definitive perspective. Under a White Sky was named one of the best books of the year by, among others, The Washington Post, Time Magazine, and Esquire. It's a pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Colbert to Path to Zero. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, we're going to talk a lot about your book, Under a White Sky, but let's start by talking about the title. Explain to the listeners why you named it Under a White Sky.
Well, the book, as I guess readers will, your listeners will come to learn, is really about a lot of interesting, exciting, or scary interventions that people are thinking about. In some cases, they're underway. In some cases, they're just more speculative to counter the effects of sort of previous interventions in the natural world. And Under White Sky refers to what might be called the ultimate intervention in the natural world, which is solar geoengineering, which is this idea that you, to counter the effects of global warming, you would shoot some kind of reflective material into the stratosphere, and that would reflect sunlight back to space, so less direct sunlight would hit the Earth, and that could counteract some or all of, depending how much you put up there, of the CO2 that we've dumped in the atmosphere. And one of the effects, there are many potential side effects of this, and many people consider it, you know, a very, very, very bad idea. One of the potential side effects, or one of the side effects, actually, it's not even a potential, it's pretty clearly, it would change the color of the sky, it would make the sky look lighter.
Unbelievable. And, you know, just a fascinating read as we got into it. You know, you said in an interview that the book was really intended to be sort of a dark comedy. Really, was that true? And kind of talk to us more about that approach.
Yes, it's definitely intended to be a dark comedy. It has a, you know, a lot of these stories follow sort of the law of unintended consequences. People do something, you know, we can talk about some of the interventions that people have made that have turned out to have sort of surprising effects, and then they go searching for a fix. And, you know, those have a kind of a, you know, a comic element built into them, you know, of mishaps and misthinking, but they're also very, very serious. I mean, these are very, very serious issues. Obviously, talking about solar geoengineering has a dark comic aspect to it. And it also has a very, you know, real world frightening aspect to it. So I hope to balance that. And I hoped that the stories would, you know, though most of them are pretty, maybe the emphasis is on dark more than comedy, but I hope that the comic element comes through.
Yeah, I think it does, at least as I was reading, I found some of it comical, I guess. You know, we'll put in a link to your website in the episode notes. You've gotten so many great photos of where you stopped as you were researching the book. Love the pictures around the disappearing Louisiana coast, pictures of the Great Barrier Reef, and then also Greenland. You know, the first chapter is called Down the River, and you talk there about the Asian carp in the Chicago River with a kind of a cool story around electric barriers. But talk to our listeners about a bit of that story. And then did you choose that issue to start the book? Because it's probably one of the better examples of, it's almost farcical, I think, the lengths that people will go to try and control that which is uncontrollable.
Yeah, so the story of the Asian carp, you know, is a story of an intervention in the natural or geological world, whatever you want to call it, where all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century, Chicago undertook this massive construction project. It was perhaps the biggest construction project of its day. This is in the pre-Panama Canal days, to reverse the flow of the Chicago River. So the Chicago River, which anyone who's been to Chicago has seen, you know, runs right through the center of the city. And it used to run from the center of the city into Lake Michigan. And as Chicago grew, it was very important. It was basically the sewer that took all the waste from the city and from the city's immense stockyards, flushed it out of the city, and it flushed it straight into Lake Michigan, which is, as it happens, very significantly where Chicago gets its drinking water. So that became a bigger and bigger problem, and that's why they decided to reverse the flow of the river by building this, digging this long canal, the Sanitarian Ship Canal. And what that did was it connected the river to basically to the Mississippi River system. And now Chicago's waste, instead of flowing into Lake Michigan, it flows all the way down the Mississippi and out into the Gulf of Mexico. And what this did, it solved one problem. It solved the problem of, you know, dumping your sewage and your drinking water, but it created a new problem. And the new problem is that you've now connected two drainage basins that used to be separate, the Great Lakes and the Mississippi. And the significance of that has become abundantly clear in the last few decades, as both of these systems have become really loaded with invasive species. And one of the invasive species is Asian carp, which people have probably heard about. They have really taken over the Mississippi River system, and people don't want them in the Great Lakes. And what they've done now is taken this sort of fake river that they built, and they've electrified a section of it. They pump a lot of, the Army Corps of Engineers is in charge. They pump a lot of electricity through the water. And the idea is to keep these carp on the Mississippi side of the border, and so that they don't get into the Great Lakes. It's unclear whether this is going to keep them out of the Great Lakes. We keep hearing getting little stories that we found carp very close to the Great Lakes. But that's the idea. And so I think I say in the book, you know, first you reverse river, then you electrify it. That's sort of our approach to a lot of these problems. And the reason I began the book with it is, as you say, it's a very good example of what I'm talking about. It's very clear and concrete, and it's already happening. We've already reversed the river and we've already electrified the river.
And I think it really does speak very eloquently, I think, to what you really say throughout the book is the complexity of, I'll use the word geoengineering, but I think it's even quite a bit more than that. And just the complexity of those systems, and it would be almost impossible to know what you don't know. And I think you make that point over and over. You know, it's funny, I was preparing for this today and reading, you know, your work on carbon removal, because you're quite detailed in a lot of research around carbon removal. And at the same time, I was reading a few financial reports this morning about kind of the latest and greatest of direct air capture. And it struck me kind of the inconsistencies in those two. But I take it you've kind of developed a view, I think, if you would, on removing carbon from the atmosphere. Is that true? And if that's true, would you share it with us?
Well, one thing I think is important to just point out is you know, there are two things that often get conflated. One is carbon capture and storage, where you would, you know, capture carbon at a major emitter, like a power plant, let's say, where the proportion of CO2 in the waste stream is relatively high. And then there's direct air capture, where it's just ordinary air, and the proportion of carbon dioxide, though way higher than it should be, is still, you know, relatively low. And those have different implications and have different levels of difficulty, as it were. And I think that the idea that we're going to use direct air capture to offset in any meaningful way what we're putting up there is probably folly. You know, it's just too energetically, it takes a lot of energy to do it. It's just not feasible. We'd be a lot better off just not putting that carbon up there to begin with. Now, in terms of carbon capture and storage, I think, you know, for better or worse, you can make a case that there are certain things that are going to be very, very hard to decarbonize, certain processes, and there may be a role for carbon and capture and storage for those particular very hard to decarbonize processes.
Yes, I thought it was really well said, and that's actually kind of helps me with my understanding. You know, I want to talk about what most people call the energy transition. I think when you write a book like this, you begin to form, you know, your own views, and you've certainly shown some of them in here. But I actually refuse to call this an energy transition because I think it's far more bumpy than when I hear the word transition, I think of something that's almost imperceptible, where I tend to call this a transformation, because there will be winners, there'll be losers, people will be, and we see it in Europe today. Some people are cold, some people are actually having to choose between food or heat, and that's in a mild winter. So clearly, as you write a book like this, you begin to shape your views. And maybe I'd love to hear your views about this energy transformation. And then secondly, so much uproar as we begin thinking about the next conference of the parties announced, I guess, yesterday, or at least in my reading, that it's going to be led by a member of the Saudi oil ministry, and a lot of furor over, you know, big oil, if you would, maybe even biggest oil leading that transition. So I'd love to hear about your role of existing big energy. I don't limit it to big oil. It can be big natural gas. It could be big electricity, whomever. You know, about the role. I want you to hear about your role, but your view of the energy transformation, but also your views on how big energy can play in it.
Well, that's a huge question, I have to say. And I also want to, you know, preface my remarks by saying, you know, I'm not in the energy industry. I don't even really report on the energy industry per se, although sometimes my reporting intersects with the energy industry. And I think that, you know, clearly we need, as you say, you know, we need a massive transformation. You know, in my opinion, I don't think it's a very radical opinion. We need, you know, we cannot, if we want a habitable planet for our kids, and we are really talking about, we are already seeing, you know, major disruptions in our world owing to climate change. And that is only going to get worse. I think people have to understand that. You know, sometimes, a lot of times, I talk to people. I was just talking to someone the other day. Here we are in the Northeast. We've had basically a snowless winter. I live in a part of the world where it should be ski country, and people were complaining about it. And this guy said to me, "Oh, but it'll switch around. You know, these things always do." And that's not true. They don't always switch around. When you are pouring a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you have to, you know, come to grips with that. It's not turning around. We're only getting warmer and warmer. We might have an occasional cold year, but we're going to see more and more very, very damaging results if we continue on the path we're on of creating 80% of the world's primary energy is created from burning fossil fuels. And we have to, in my opinion, we have to bring that down as close to zero as possible. Now, that, as you say, creates a lot of winners and a lot of losers. And I think that the Everyone understands that. I think the big oil companies understand that. And I think that, you know, the UAE, which is hosting the next COP, they understand it. And I think that smart companies will be in the business of providing energy, not providing energy with fossil fuels. But there are a lot of, you know, stranded assets as a result of that. There are a lot of, you know, oil fields that should not be developed. As a result, there's a lot of natural gas plays that should not, you know, be developed. And how we as a society, you know, turn that ship around, turn this battleship around, that's the question of our time. And that's why people are, you know, one of the reasons, and I share the concern that putting, you know, the oil minister of the UAE in charge of the next COP is not necessarily, you know, is not sending the right signal. Maybe he's a very forward-thinking person. Maybe he's someone who really wants to transform the industry. But he's presumably constrained by one set of economic interests that represent the status quo. And we need to be thinking, you know, way beyond the status quo.
Yeah, well said. Elizabeth, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com. Maybe I'll win if I zero.
Welcome back. We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert, author of Under a White Sky and writer for The New Yorker. If you will, I'd like to shift over to your work in The New Yorker, really probably one of the finest journalistic pieces I ever get to touch. You know, you recently summarized three major climate reports just released. When you released that, maybe what were some of the things that stood out to you with those reports?
So the three reports were, one was a report that showed that U.S. emissions actually ticked up last year. You know, they had been declining in general, and then they really took a sharp jump down during COVID when we all stayed home, and now they've been ticking up again, and they're basically where they were pre-COVID. And, you know, as your listeners probably know, there's a real been a lot of you know, work being done, and there's a, you know, this goal sort of enshrined in a lot of state laws and even now in federal legislation to try to, you know, reach certain benchmarks of decarbonization by 2035, which is not very far away. And we cannot afford, you know, any uptick in emissions. So that was one report that stood out. Another report was from an international group, and that one just pointed out that the last 8 years have been the eight hottest years on record. And that is, you know, that's a very important data point. And one of the reasons that that's a particularly important data point is because we've been in this extended weather pattern called La Nina, which actually traditionally brings cooler temperatures. And if we go, if and when we will eventually go into an El Nino, we will get a really, really hot year. And people are predicting that not this year, but next year will probably be a record-breakingly hot year. And we will see a lot of consequences from that. And so that was one of the other reports. And those reports put together, I think, paint, you know, a pretty clear picture of that we need to be working harder. Oh, and another report was from the Biden administration that talked about how we really need to decarbonize transportation, because as the grid gets cleaner, actually owing to putting up wind and solar, transportation is now the major source of emissions in the U.S. And we really need to be rethinking how we get around, because that is a huge chunk of emissions.
Yes, true. And you know, something we work on, and we don't talk about it much, something we work on here, because while I know most people see either battery electric or hydrogen as a big fuel of the future, we can demonstrate with such clarity the emissions reduction by using propane in those, as you say, hard to electrify sections, heavy duty trucking, medium duty trucking. And so we're always trying to get a voice there, but I will tell you, reduce NOx 97%, reduce particulate matter 100%, reduce operating cost 50%. There's so many good things that we're working on that, you know, we love to share as that conversation around transportation really heats up. All right, let's have some fun, Elizabeth. This is the part where we have a little fun, and I love having writers do this, because I find, you know, your mind's not necessarily just limited to linear things like scientists sometimes. I'm going to hand you a magic wand. You can use that magic wand to change one thing in the next year that, in your view, would have the largest impact regarding climate change. How would you use that wand?
Well, this is a pretty, you know, standard answer. Unfortunately, it's not as creative as you might hope, coming from a writer. I'm sorry, but I think I would impose some kind of a charge on carbon. I think we need to, you know, incentivize energy sources that are low carbon and de-incentivize energy sources that are high carbon. I think, you know, one of the techniques that, you know, the Biden administration is using that you see in the Inflation Reduction Act is we give a lot of tax credits. We have a lot of carrots for low carbon energy, but we don't have a lot that's actually getting rid of high carbon energy sources. And one of the fears is that you're just going to end up, you know, with both, and that's not going to really reduce your emissions. So I would put a charge on carbon, on fuels based on their carbon, you know, output.
Good use of your wand. Let me ask you, because I think almost every economist on the planet would agree with you in that statement, that that's probably the logical way. But how do you keep that tool out of the hands of politicians and into the hands of economists and business, you think? How do you do that?
Well, you know, how do you do that with any policy? You know, I think that, you know, on some level, we don't have to worry about that, because it's really, you know, so politically difficult that, you know, no politician wants to go near it. If and when we get to the point where politicians do want to go near it, you know, I think that you're right to suggest that we need to design it very in a very intelligent way to get, you know, as it were, the biggest bang for our buck and not have a lot of carve outs. You know, one of the problems that we've seen when we've seen climate legislation in various parts of the world, other parts of the world, not necessarily the US, and they will do a cap and trade, which is, you know, sort of similar to a tax, but, you know, you'll get these, you get a lot of lobbying by people, you get a lot of carve outs, and your policy will be that much less effective as a result. So, you know, how do you do that? You know, people need to be, I would argue, people really need to be informed, and they need to make this issue a priority, and they need to, you know, watch what's going on.
Yeah, that's good. Great. All right. So we do one other fun thing. We love to recognize you for your time and your expertise, you know, for being with us on Path to Zero. So we have a national forest, and we like to plant a tree in a place in your name. So I know you live in Massachusetts. You got great forest in Massachusetts, the Petersham, Shelburne. You don't have to go very far to get to Vermont with a whole nother slew of great national forests. You get to pick the place. Anywhere that stands out for you?
Where I'd like to plant my tree?
Yes.
Oh, wow. And it can be any national forest, or it doesn't even have to be national forest.
We've had guests ask to plant a tree in the Amazon, but yeah, we generally think of a place that's special to you. So yeah, yes.
Okay. I guess I would maybe plant it, in the Green Mountains, which are pretty close to me, in Vermont, which are beautiful national forest. Yeah, great.
The place I try to get to at least once a summer, just it's so beautiful and cool. That's a great place, and we'll do that. Elizabeth, I want to commend you on what I believe is your third book. Is that right? Your third book?
Yep.
And I want to recommend it, Under a White Sky. I must say, as good as the beginning and the middle are, I think the afterword was particularly wonderful really worthy of reading. It's rare to see someone touch Trump and COVID and then the future of the planet in one section. It was wonderful. Thank you today. Thank you for being our guest on Path to Zero.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That wraps up this episode of Path to Zero. Several of our guests have been suggested by our listeners. We really encourage you to do the same. The best way to do it is to give us input by email. The address is path2zero@propane.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.